As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello, and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm JJ Bull, and today I am joined by the mysterious Alex Stewart. Hello.
I am mysterious.
You are. What's the most mysterious thing you've done in the last 3 days?
Obviously, I can't tell you that.
Because it's mysterious. Good. This has started weirdly. And then also we're joined by everyone's best friend. He loves you all as we love him. It's Seb Stafford-Lohr.
Hello, JJ Bull.
Hello, Seb. Oh, you seem much happier than last week.
That is, I've recovered from illness. Levels of chirpiness.
No, I've had a nasty bit of bronchitis, but I've recovered. I've still got a cough and I'm still not sleeping well, but I am happy to be on the other end of the illness. Yes.
Well, you know what, boys and girls, you are in for a real treat. We've got a chirpy Seb, a mysterious Alex, and there's loads of football to talk about. And we're going to do all of that. We're going to talk about all the Arsenals and the Liverpools and the Man Cities and all the other things. And yeah, it's going to be a real treat. And if you like treats, well, what better treat could you get than by going to theathletic.com/TIFO? What do you get, Alex?
You get access to unparalleled sports coverage.
For how long?
I guess as long as you like, really.
Yes.
I mean, it depends, doesn't it?
Alex has gone for the hard sell here. So what happens if you go to this mysterious link Alex is alluding to is that you will get a trial to read The Athletic and all the many things on it. Like today, for instance, we're recording this on a Monday, you could have read David Ornstein's column and all about how there's some things happening with Erling Haaland possibly going to Manchester City, and Paul Pogba isn't going to Manchester City. That would have been funny though. Mm-hmm. What else is happening, Seb?
Hey, so I've been reading Simon Johnson's work on the new Chelsea owner. It's been very, very interesting. Yeah, it's been gone for a while, but Simon's done a super job covering it. And read a little bit of Charlie Eccleshare and Jack Pitbrook after Tottenham got their draw at Anfield. That's been fun. And yeah, I mean, it's a trial, but it's a trial in name only. You'll trial it and then you'll be doing it full time properly. Not trial, just forever.
And you're becoming a member of a club, an exclusive club where you want to be a member.
A good club, not one of those bad ones that, you know.
Yeah. Not like the Marx Brothers joke where you don't want to be part of it. You do want to be part of this club. That's enough of a sell. Okay. Yes, we need to move on. I need to move and say the thing that Joe always says. Joe always says, because he's not here again. We're going to leave you now in the cool arms and warm arms of Alex Stewart.
Of arms.
Of the arms.
Arms,
of arms.
Arms, yeah. Of arms, yeah.
Liverpool 1-1 Tottenham. It's written here, form as expected. Liverpool dominated the ball. Spurs happy to play on the counter-attack. What did you think of Spurs' approach to this game, Alex Stewart?
Sensible. I think people are predisposed to be annoyed about teams not going for stuff.
Is this reference to Villarreal and
that kind of... It's a general reference. But I think as Eric Dyer pointed out in the post-match interview, you know, Spurs had a very organized defensive system, as you would expect from a Conte side. And they also had patterns that they had clearly rehearsed that allowed them to counterattack. And if you have Song Heung-min and Harry Kane up front, then there is always a possibility that you only need one or two counterattacks to score. And it seems to me like Spurs are in a weird position because they are currently well set up to frustrate bigger teams like this, but obviously they're in this top four race. They have aspirations to be better. They have a world-class manager. And so I can understand why there might be some frustration about this, but let's not forget that Liverpool are exceptionally good.
And the frustration is from Liverpool.
Right. Well, the frustration is partly from Liverpool, yes. But also I think there's this kind of sense of like, oh, teams should just be, you know, Liverpool and Man City are so much better than everybody else that even the best sides have to play this way. And I thought Spurs executed their game plan really quite effectively.
There was I can't remember who did it on Twitter, so I'm really sorry if it was you. I think it was a coach or someone with an actual UEFA qualification. You pointed out that the way that Spurs were building from the back, that the it was basically a back five with the wing backs. One of them would push really, the left wing back would push up really high to be next to Alexander-Arnold, and the right wing back would fall really short. So it became a back four with the right wing back, the right centre back, and the middle centre back, and the left centre back, forming the four. And then that meant that basically Robertson, to keep his position, he was caught between wanting to stay near the rest of the back four to keep position or being dragged out towards where the right wing back, who was Emerson Royale, wasn't it? So he had that space to cover, which then meant when he did go to that position, they'd be able to get the ball over the top of him into Kulusevski, who's been so good. Seth, tell me about Kulusevski. He's been great this season.
Yeah, he really has been. And I think a couple of things about him. Very, very quick, very, very skillful, very direct. Most important quality I think that he has is the contrast that he poses to Harry Kane and Son Heung-min. Like previously, like before he arrived, Conte was typically playing Lucas Moura as the third of his forwards. And Moura is a good player. He's skillful. He's a goal threat. Doesn't provide that contrast. He's right-footed rather than left. Kulusevski's left-footed. And there isn't a lot of craft in his game. He's a very direct player. Like I wouldn't say he's a head down kind of footballer, but there is an element of the best player in the playground to him because he can beat everybody. And so he doesn't quite, after he's beaten a couple of defenders, he was never quite sure of when the right time to release the ball was, release the pass was. Whereas Kulusevski very much does. And so whilst also having the ability to go past players, because he's a big guy as well, and there's a little bit of devilment to him. He's not, he's a little bit of aggro to his football. He can be a little bit confrontational, which is nice, but he has this craft and he's a little bit like, I suppose his Spurs parallel might be someone like Eric Lamella, but he's a kind of a bigger, bulkier, quicker, more direct Eric Lamella, but just with some of those creative abilities too. And I think just the way that he's just a nice foil to that Son Kane thing. Because he actually does something slightly different and he occupies slightly different areas of the pitch and his tendencies on the ball are a little bit different. And he's been great. He's been had a little bit of a lull over the last couple of weeks, but that's kind of to be expected from a January signing. But he's been terrific.
What's he? So he's 22 years old and in 15 appearances, including three sub-appearances in the league, he's got 8 assists and 3 goals. So that's, what if you want to call it, 11 goal contributions in 12 starts. That's, I mean, in the Premier League, that's really, really high. He's sort of, I don't think he's going under the radar because people are, I like talking about him and other people have. He's not, he's definitely, like he is on the radar, but he's like on the outside of it. Like, you know, when the aliens are in the, you know, when they're going through an aliens and they're going through the tunnels, the corridors, and then there's all the aliens coming and it's like, oh, he's right above us. Kulusevski is not right above them. He's on the right wing.
Another thing about him is that it feels like, and I say this without using any data or anecdotes to support the point I'm about to make, is it feels
okay,
like
it's just an opinion.
It's the best kind of point to make. It's just the one that feels right. Is that it feels like he's helped the progression a little bit of the ball because previously Lucas Moura wasn't someone that could really collect the ball around the halfway line or deep in his own half with any success or sort of move it up the field with any success. Whereas Kulusevski, because he's so strong and because he's so technical and because he's kind of comfortable, just having the ball. He doesn't have that compulsion always to run forwards with it. It feels like when he collects it, and that can be in his own half, things can develop around him and then the ball can move. And part of that is, obviously, in addition to signing him, Spurs bought Rodrigo Bentancur, who's he's been really great, actually. He's been excellent since he arrived, and his ball progression is fantastic. But Kulusevski's ticks that box too, and that's allowed a few other things to happen in sort of non-attacking areas, which has been very nice, aside from all the alien stuff that you were talking about that I was kind of semi-listening to.
Yes, no, I sort of zoned out while I was saying it. Yeah. Do you know what another thing I was thinking about Kulusevski, right? Probably Bentancur as well as counts for. So, I mean, I know more for Kulusevski. Didn't really quite work for him at Juventus, which is obviously top, like fighting for the title. Well, not now, but they, you know, they have been in the past. It's a lot of pressure. That's our level club. I'm not trying to diss Spurs, but I mean, he's going to a smaller place. He's going to a smaller level, right? Where suddenly he is now able to play that level and get better. It's almost like he can turn into the finished article like Harry Kane did at Spurs. Because if Kane had gone somewhere like Man United, obviously, because no one ever gets better at Man United, he would have just turned into dust. But Kulusevski now is at the point where he's able to play at the level where he can get into, I don't know, they're fighting for Champions League spots. Does this make sense what I'm saying, right? It's easier at a club with less pressure than he can become the player that could play at a higher level.
I feel maybe, so I had a few things about him before he joined. Apparently he struggled a little bit with playing alongside Cristiano Ronaldo. Had a difficult time as a young guy dealing with the expectation of, you know, Ronaldo's pretty demanding, you know, when he wants the ball and where he wants the ball and what he wants his teammates to do around him. And Kulusevski didn't really thrive under those conditions. Whereas Spurs, I think you're immediately one of the better players. And so he's not the best player on the team, but you're already kind of, you feel secure in your starting place. You're not having to duel with someone like Dybala, for instance, for your role week to week. There isn't the same level of scrutiny. At Spurs, you can probably get away with chucking in a kind of an anonymous performance once every couple of weeks at the moment, in their kind of, at their current stage, because they're an okay team. They're getting a bit better. They might finish in the Champions League places, they might not, but it's not a kind of, people move on pretty quickly from a bad performance. Whereas Juventus, probably less so. I don't have much experience of what the Juventus fan base is like, but I imagine it's not quite as forgiving. And particularly when you kind of have some pretty big personalities in the dressing room to compete with, which he doesn't really, I suppose. So it probably suits him.
I've just thought, we haven't spoken on this podcast about the Champions League final and the teams who got through to that yet, have we? Or am I?
We really did a live wrong? Stream about it, though.
We did a live stream, which is not the same thing.
It felt sort of, the live stream was kind of chaotic, if you remember it. We were kind of frazzled, and it had come at the end of a very, very long day. And I think I ended up saying that Camavinga wasn't very good, and very clearly he was. And I humiliated myself. From that.
You've made your apology now. It's fine.
I felt like I needed to apologize for that. That was a bad, bad take. Stone cold take.
Well, Alex, now we've got Liverpool are in the Champions League final. And this draw doesn't mean they're out of the league title. I think actually it's still very, very tight. It's only 2 points off. If Man City lose a game, then they would climb above them, wouldn't they?
3 points.
3 points. Oh, yep. Well, that's better. Oh, well. I'm all wrong as well. But do you think, I asked this to Seb the other day, do you think Liverpool would prefer to swap winning the league for the Champions League, you know, if you had the choice? What do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's a really interesting aspect of football, which is obviously really difficult to talk about with any kind of certainty, but it's the psychological impact of those two Champions League results on their respective teams. Like Liverpool, you can make an argument for Liverpool going, okay, well, we've got a good chance in the Champions League final and we should focus on that, and that's where we should direct our energies, and the league title is gone. Or it could provide an impetus. We're still competing on all these different fronts. We've still got the possibility of winning, what is it, the quadruple. We should give everything to all of that. Man City could crush them. I mean, we'll talk about them against Newcastle, obviously, but it's the bit that is hardest, I think, for anybody, whether it's probably a manager or a player, but also certainly pundits, fans, and so on, to get a handle on, like, what are the impacts of these kinds of results. I think if you're Liverpool, there is a thing about the Premier League title. I suspect that's probably why Pep Guardiola referenced it specifically in that post-match interview that he did with BN Sports, which was, whatever. But, you know, giving some niggle to that aspect, you know, focusing on the fact that, yeah, okay, Liverpool have won a couple of Champions Leagues in the last 30 years, but they've only won one Premier League title, unlike us. You know, that stokes the pressure a little bit. Klopp might look at that and go, well, you know, we're 3 points behind, we're on the same number of games. They've got a better goal difference, and the Champions League is the thing they can't seem to win, so let's do that instead. You know, it's like, who knows really what goes through any of these people's minds.
Well, how about a more Tifo-ish question, which actually suits the podcast, rather than generic
all
football
that effort
man.
Into a,
it was into fine. A it was fine. Answer. I want to use the things you know well, though. So, sort of referencing this Liverpool Spurs game and also the Villarreal semi final, I've read a lot of people who have said that maybe Liverpool didn't play very well in the first half against Villarreal. It was like, for me, it's not they didn't play very well, it's that Villarreal went at them, which is a natural consequence of playing away in a massive semi-final. That's just what happens. I mean, you can see, are you not playing well if you're a bit frazzled by a team going straight at you? Like, I'm trying to work out if that means you're not playing well or how you can play better by just being more confident. Or, like, against Spurs here, Spurs obviously, it's written down in these notes even, like, it's by design that they were forcing them wide to try and cross the ball, and they were trying to force them so they knew where they were able to hit them. So it wasn't that Liverpool weren't playing badly, but they were being lured into a trap, which may or may not have worked.
Yeah, a little bit. I think to a degree with this Liverpool performance against Spurs, there were some uncharacteristic sloppy passes that you don't tend to see quite so much with Liverpool. But yeah, like, teams, you set your side up, particularly if you're playing against a stronger team, to not just mitigate their strengths, but also to try to set the game out on your terms as much as possible. And that might be pressing incredibly aggressively particular players. It might be forcing the ball into particular areas. It might be sitting very, very low and compressing the space between the lines. You know, whatever it is that works for you, that's what you're supposed to do. And if that is executed effectively, it's not necessarily harder to coach attack, but I think it's more glaring when things in attack that you're used to seeing functioning well don't. And that means that not enough credit is given to good and intelligent defensive systems. Also because the narrative, the expectation is Liverpool and City are going to crush everyone, right? So I think it's very easy to go, oh, well, they didn't do it because they weren't on their game, rather than a very, very good, as I say, world-class manager working with an excellent squad that is particularly suited to a certain style of play. I mean, Spurs can look incredibly effective on the counter-attack. They can be one of the best counter-attacking teams in the league, for sure, with the players that they have at their disposal. So, yeah, it's credit to them rather than Liverpool being necessarily that bad.
I mean, criticism of Liverpool, I mean, remember, this is a Spurs team that beat Man City home and away this season. And also, you know, took a point off Liverpool at White Hart Lane. They are, like, I think most Spurs fans, myself included, are prone to fatalism ahead of these kind of games. But a more measured perspective is that Spurs are built, probably by accident, in a way that suits these kind of matches.
Exactly does.
And that's been shown again and again. And actually, look, they a couple of times they've conceded bad goals, which have disguised this, but their record at Anfield in terms of the performances they've given has tended to involve good moments undone by stupid sloppiness, which kind of transcend tactical kind of organisation. But they've done pretty well at times, even if the scorelines and feeling that comes after the game hasn't always reflected that.
Well, I think we've talked an awful lot about Liverpool and Spurs now, and I'd like to move on to Brighton 4-0, Manchester United. Oh my God. What is going on there? Like, yeah. So United, like, they're more or less guaranteed six is the way I see it in the league, right? And the players have just fallen apart.
Well, West Ham might catch them. I mean,
They could do. They shouldn't. They shouldn't be able to lose sixth place. They've got one game left, I think, now at the time of recording this. What has Rangnick even done there? Like, is he doing the right thing? Is he unraveling it now? It's like the jumper's starting to come apart, but he started pulling the threads to get rid of it so they can put on a different jump. I don't know what this analogy is. I don't know what they are.
Well, I think the problem is they don't know what they are either, and I think we've talked about this a lot before, but you have a club where post Ferguson, where obviously there was in some respects an emphasis on developing players through Carrington and bringing them into the first team, although to a degree that's overplayed on the basis of one particular generation, but it was a thing and it was nice. They don't really haven't had for a while a footballing identity. And by that, I mean a style of play that you would particularly associate with them. They're not gegenpressing. They're not positional play. They're not press and possess. They are, let's try and hire some quite good people, or in the instance of a couple, some very good people, and see what happens, is a bit their style, right? And then you bring in someone like Ranić, who is closely associated with a very specific and, for what it's worth, very difficult style of play to coach. And you ask him to do that in a very short period of time with a squad that he's not assembled, having not actually coached himself for a significant period of time. So it's like dangling the illusion of identity in front of somebody and then whisking it away and them going, oh, we still don't know what to do.
It's where you see that the power of management is often down to things like, it's nothing to do with football even. It's just management, like charisma, leadership. Can you own that dressing room? Is it too divided already? It's because of lots of old mismanagement. There's a quote in their notes we have, too much space, too much time. The problem is how to defend as a team. And that is by Ralph Rangnick. So Seb, why is he not, if he's saying these things, that like he must be trying to fix it in training. What's the issue here?
Yeah, not to lean into a kind of a proper football mannerism, but I was watching the first goal again this morning and I feel like that told me everything I needed to know about that team. Because if you see, like, there's a, before Caicedo scores, there's an initial move which kind of breaks down a little bit and the ball drops just in front of the Man United penalty box. Now, if you go back and watch this, look at the response of those Man United players to that happening. They just stand there and watch it happen. Like, watch Bruno Fernandes just stand there, not picking on him, it's just kind of, he was emblematic of an attitude. And I don't know if this is...
Did he then start throwing his arms around and blaming someone else? Because I see him do this all the time.
Yeah, if he didn't do it, then I'm sorry. He's just done it so many times that I imagine he probably did. But it's a wonderful goal. And I want to be careful not to take anything away from Brighton, because it was such a wonderful moment for Graham Potter. And a couple of my Brighton supporting friends were just so happy. And they deserved it. They were so good. They were so, so good. But they do the thing that they've been taught. This is the Man United players. And then they don't respond with any kind of enthusiasm or application to kind of the ad hoc situations that present themselves in football, because that's kind of, I don't know, beyond their responsibility somehow. It's pretty shameful.
They've been doing it for ages as well. I remember, like, even under Solskjaer, they were, the first half they were useless, and in the second half they come out, and because they are really good players, they managed to be able to fix something.
Well, they busked it for so long on the basis of individual talent, didn't they? But this sort of thing, too much space, too much time, the Ranić quote, and Carl Anker's written a superb piece on The Athletic, which all of you obviously are taking advantage of your free trial. If you're not already subscribers, you should read that. But it does come down an awful lot to effort. The reason that there is so much space between the lines is because the lines aren't compressing. The reason that vertical compactness and horizontal compactness works is because a team is well-drilled to get into those positions and works hard to ensure that those positions are correct. And further to that, the reason that teams defend that way and then expand out is because, as like Cruyff and many others have said, when you're defending, you want to make the playing area as small as possible. And when you're attacking, you want to make it as big as possible. And yes, that requires tactical intelligence and technical ability and blah, blah, blah. But it also requires effort. If you're going to go from small to big, it requires effort, right? And that's, they don't do that. It's just really annoying.
I think there's a
whereas if you contrast it with Brighton, and you're right, Seb. Like this will be yet another post-mortem on United, and the corpse is dead. There's no point in prodding it any further. Brighton were exceptional tactically, right? The use of Cucurella as a left-sided centre-back slash left winger. Wow. You know, and this is a player who was kind of like a defensive hard nut type of player when he came over from La Liga. He was not this sort of marauding...
It's really highly rated when he came over. He's one of the good scouting ones, isn't he?
Absolutely. He's a very good player, but he wasn't... Like, this is testament to Potter's phenomenal coaching and also the scouting system run by Dan Ashworth.
Yeah, definitely.
Caicedo as well, another good example. But these are players who are not just coached to play interesting tactical patterns. This is a team that two or three games ago started with seven central midfielders and three defenders, right? And they're now playing this system. They did that kind of penduluming four at the back, five at the back thing that you were referring to Spurs doing before as well. Like, there are full, that this team is full of tactical intelligence and complexity and interesting stuff. They also work really fucking hard. They run and they run and they run. And that's why it works, because they know what they're supposed to be doing, but they can also be bothered to try and do it repeatedly.
I think it's so good that you brought up Cucurella, because he's such a noticeable player on the pitch because of his hair. You see how hard he works to kind of create that dynamic with, most, more often than not, Trossard down the left-hand side. I think one of the things I've enjoyed most about Brighton is his willingness to get into certain positions so that something else can happen which doesn't involve him having the ball. I think that's a really selfless way for a football player to behave, but the exact thing that doesn't happen at Man United. Like, if you look at, okay, so that on that first goal, like, what you'd expect to happen in that situation, the ball breaks down in front of the box, you'd expect a defence to kind of close in on the player like a fist and to just starve the oxygen, take away the space, and it doesn't happen. And in direct comparison, you've got a player making the run purely to drag a defender slightly out of position by a yard or two so something can happen internally. Like, it's a dramatic difference.
And teams need these kinds of players. And I know we're jumping ahead and we'll probably talk about it in a bit, but I watched the Arsenal game on Sunday, and Tomiyasu, who was playing out of position at left back, consistently doing the same stuff, making weird, like, left half space runs with Xhaka pulling outside him, or but this was a player who was making those runs irrespective of whether they thought they would get the ball or not, because they knew that by doing so they would occupy opposition players, they would create space for somebody else. And if it didn't work, like, four times out of five, Tomiyasu wouldn't get the ball and he'd chug back to his starting position and he'd do the same thing again, because that's what he knows his job is. Well, and he's putting the effort in.
That's the thing, sort of, to try and link United and Brighton. I think you can see Brighton clearly very well coached, which is why they perform so well. So it's very well coached, right? With players who are probably far more malleable than they are at Man United. So they're at a certain level that they can take instruction because they know they are against it. Like, their
weight budget was shown. It's
that's 11, one thing. Yeah. But then that's how the coach comes in and can affect that. And it's not just Potter, you know, he's got a team of coaches doing it. Rangnick's got his own team. Same things we see in Man United have been there for a few years now. So they're slow to start. They don't do the things they're supposed to. They expect that everyone else should be doing the stuff that they're not doing. It's like blaming someone else for some things you haven't done. That seems to always happen. And that's a really hard thing to get rid of. That's not just coaching on the training ground. That's getting rid of stuff all around the club. It's an atmosphere you can't get rid of. But, like, A lot of noise were made of the boy Caicedo. He scored that the first goal, right? So a really nice hit, the way he takes it. And people were saying he's going to be a good midfielder. And I think you said as well, Seb, you think he'd be a good player in time, right? So Caicedo is at the age where he's not the top player he's going to be, but people can see he's probably going to be it. Same with Cucurella. He's becoming a player that could easily get snapped up by a top team now, could easily take him, but as part of a team that's developing and can go somewhere. Now, Caicedo, if he, this is a Man United fan, would love to play there because that's what he watched. If he'd gone to Man United, he would have just turned to dust like the other players, because he wouldn't have been able to do it. There's no room to develop. You've got players like Fred McTominay, who were not the finished article when they signed, and are just crumbling. And that, like, sometimes they have good games, sometimes they don't, because you know, you have good games and you're surrounded by good players and you've got all these lads here. But you see the difference in, like, if Graham Potter went to United now, the exact same things would happen at United that are happening now as they were before. That's the thing. Same like Kulusevski at Spurs, same thing, right? He's got room to develop and he'll become the player that Juventus know he can become, but he's going to be a Spurs player soon, but he can only do it because he's gone there. Caicedo wouldn't be able to do it in Man United. Who they bring in the summer is incredibly difficult to work out, because they sort of need the finished article already, who is also at a level they want to step it up. I don't know if they exist. That's all I've got for you. And I've beaten the panel.
No, you're absolutely right about all of it. And I also think that, yeah, obviously, if you're working in the technical scouting department, say at Man United, I suspect there is a degree of frustration. And I say this not knowing anything about this, but I would imagine that there is no reason why the people who are working in that scouting team at Man United are not as clever and as good at their jobs as the people doing it at all the other departments. It's just that at somewhere like Brighton, because there is a holistic understanding of the process and there is buy-in from top to bottom, all the way up to the chairman slash owner of that club, into how that system should work, those people that are doing the scouting and the analytics and recommending players from the Ecuadorian Prima are being listened to. Whereas at Man United, you can do all of that work and you can flag all of the same people and then you can present them with the list and they're like, yeah, no, actually we want to sign Cristiano Ronaldo again on 300 grand a week because that'll say fuck you to Man City. It's like, okay, what's the point? I should go and work somewhere else. Like if I was starting to be interested in football for the first time now and wasn't already a Southampton fan, Brighton is the kind of team that I would look at and go, that is exactly how stuff should be run. It would be really exciting to be a Brighton fan at the moment.
Also, environment is what we're talking about, because if you talk to a scout, like Alex is right, because the one frustration you always hear is scouts or people who work in data, they don't get listened to enough. The other problem is that, say someone like that comes into a club and they have a recommendation to make, and the recommendation comes with some follow through from someone up in further up in the club. But then that player comes into an environment which is not conducive to development, as JJ has been talking about. Then you, because this is the way the big clubs seem to work, have a failure on your CV. It's your fault. It's not that you don't have a pliable environment in which people aren't developed or players aren't given a proper chance. You know, instead of Kulusevski coming into a Spurs, and he's much too high profile player to be in this conversation, I accept, which is using him as an example. Instead of him coming into Spurs, having a good couple of months, having a bad couple of games, but everyone's kind of, it's cool, don't worry about it, you're developing, you're growing. If instead of that, you have this kind of hysterical response to, well, you're not worth the money, and you shouldn't be allowed to make decisions, and no one should listen to you again, and shut up. That's how you create this kind of perpetual cycle of, I'm not even sure what the word is at Man United. It's like, it's funny.
Nonsense.
It is nonsense, but also like, I remember one of the stories from this season, one of the conversations has been Jadon Sancho's form and people like throwing around terms like Bundesliga tax. Like, it's not a Bundesliga tax, it's a Man United tax. Like, Jadon Sancho is a brilliant, brilliant player. Has he played at his very best? Is he responsible in part for some of his failings this season? Absolutely. But is the main problem not the environment into which he's been put and the set of decisions which have led to him joining Manchester United in the first place? Yes, of course.
Exactly.
It is.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, and yet it's easier to go, yeah, Farmers League, he's not good enough for my club, who have just signed Varane, Sancho, and Ronaldo and finished behind Spurs. I mean, come on.
Well, it's gone so well in Man United this season that the captain is now on the bench and they're going to have their lowest ever points total in the Premier League. Well done, everyone there. Well done. You've really done that very well. And I think we should talk about someone else now, yeah, after a break.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And we're back from the break.
You didn't do it. Yes.
As Joe does that.
But do it, because then it sets the tone.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. JJ's his own man.
Yeah. Also,
let
the
JJ
yes thing is mine.
Be JJ.
Because the yes is from the office, so Michael Scott does it. He goes, yes. Anyway, Leicester 1-2 Everton. Alex didn't watch this.
No.
What do you think probably happened?
I think Jordan Pickford made some great saves.
Uh-huh.
And I think, who was playing again?
Leicester and Everton.
Oh, yeah. I think Leicester are probably quite bad, despite the fact they've got some good players, one of whom they're likely to lose in the summer in Yuri Tielemans. And I think Everton were gritty and organised. And once again, we are praising the performances of Alex Iwobi.
He was close.
Okay.
He was close. But the thing is, this is, I mean, if you want to be a football writer, from what
don't
I saw
ask
of this,
me.
I think Seb, you'll know this better, but this was Football Man hat on again. We're doing this too regularly. I think this is a bad thing that I think I started. They wanted it more. Leicester are sort of already, the season's gone wrong. They're a bit disappointed. They want to start again. Everton are clinging to the bottom of the table. Has Frank Lampard done anything differently? Is there anything he's doing that's different apart from getting those boys revved up?
They're a lot better off the ball than they were.
And there you have it. Schalke 3, 2 St. Pauli. Hey,
so one thing on Leicester, because we haven't talked about Leicester properly for a while, but I think it's a little bit more complicated than just wait for the season to end and it will be fine next year, just because one of the things that happened in this game, as has happened in many, 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 many other games this season, is Leicester mm-hmm. conceded from a set piece. And
they love that, don't they? That's
they really, really
thing.
Enjoy giving cheap goals away. And one of the things that troubles me is that, yes, they've had a couple of injuries, but when you've got a problem that coaching can't fix, that's a bit of an issue beyond just, oh, we've got sort of Europa League, Conference League commitments. Well, okay, but West Ham have had injuries too, and West Ham have gone deep into European competition too with a very thin squad, and they've been pretty good for most of the year. Leicester are absolutely nowhere as a team. Coaching-wise, I don't know, you can't pin everything on Wes Fofana not being there for most of the season. That's all I'm saying. And I also think there's a kind of a conversation to be had about the goalkeeper, because Kasper Schmeichel's been excellent for a really long time, but some of these mistakes are happening too often now. And I think it's you're entering one of those kind of difficult transitions that occurs when a kind of an iconic footballer at a club starts to sort of starts to have a sort of a tenuous place in the first team.
Oh, I know this all too well. This is exactly the same thing that's happening at Aberdeen right now with Joe Lewis.
Ooh, tell me. Okay.
Joe Lewis has been probably the best goalkeeper in Scotland for a little while, but now, the last couple of seasons has started making loads of uncharacteristic mistakes, which resulted in Aberdeen's expected goals against not matching their goals against, which tends to be the case where you can tell if a goalkeeper's not good because the expected goals against is less than the goals they've let in. That's one little, and you can look into it and work out that's the thing with Joe Lewis. Interesting that Kasper Schmeichel's doing that, because you think of him as being Mr. Reliable for those lads. It's also probably the end of a cycle at Leicester, I think.
Yeah, there was also a Leicester game I watched recently where the commentator said, Schmeichel's been outstanding again this season. And I thought, he hasn't. I haven't watched much Leicester. And then I went to the...
I think we forgave the occasional lapse from commentators.
No, but this is not what I mean. Oh. I'm not digging out a commentator for once. But I went and looked at the numbers and so on. And it's like, I mean, I know numbers don't tell the whole story, but I think it feeds into what Seb's saying, that we have got so used to assuming that Kasper Schmeichel is really, really good for such a long time, that it creates a difficulty in recognizing when he has stopped being as good.
Ah, and that's when data comes in handy.
And that might be an issue to a degree in the coaching team as well. Or it's like, oh, this is a minor fluctuation or whatever it is. Whereas, you know, this is a goalkeeper clearly who has started to perform at a lower level than he has consistently done for the previous seasons. And that is alarming.
Well, it looks like Everton might actually escape this, but I think we should move on to... I want to talk about this Schalke thing, because I don't know anything about it. So Schalke beat St. Pauli 3-2, and that means Schalke promoted back to the Bundesliga. Is that a good thing? Why should I care about this, Seb?
Well, Schalke going back to the Bundesliga is a good thing, because Schalke are one of the biggest clubs in Germany, and the Bundesliga is underpowered this year. It's really great to see less fashionable clubs have their day in the sun, and that hopefully that continues. But you do need, for the sake of competition, you do need the big, powerful, traditional clubs there. And Schalke, one of those. Hartsfall, Hamburg, that's not two different clubs. Hamburg and Hartsfall are the same thing. They are another case. They might yet go up. But I think one of the problems, and it's a minor point to make alongside Bayern Munich's dominance, but one of the reasons why it's happened is because there are quite a few teams in German football, traditional clubs, who have kind of fallen into cycles of dysfunction and dropped out of the Bundesliga. So in the Zweite Bundesliga this season, ridiculously, you have Hamburg, Schalke, Werder Bremen. Like, these are all Bundesliga sides and they're all a level below. And in the Bundesliga, teams like Arminia Bielefeld and Augsburg, great stories, some of them. Unfortunately, Arminia Bielefeld have just been relegated, but they're not going to compete with Bayern Munich. They're also not going to compete with that kind of second layer of club. You know, your Borussia Dortmund, RB Leipzig, that kind of
level. I like, you didn't see
I held it off on the plurals.
You didn't make it plural.
Yeah. I could feel myself approaching it, and I was gonna.
I thought you were gonna go for it, and I would have lost respect. I would have lost respect for you.
But this was a great game. So, I desperately wanted St. Pauli to go up. Not going to pretend otherwise. My wife supports them, and they went 2 up. Unfortunately, ahead of this game, they'd had 9 COVID absences. They lost Guido Bergstoller as their top scorer. Their first choice goalkeeper was out. They lost the centre back. They were running on empty, and they've had a wonderful season. It's just that they've probably got 12 or 13 first team players who were good enough to get them promotion. And as soon as a couple of injuries happened and Kofi Kirei went off to AFCON, they suffered a little bit. But they went 2 up. Igor Matanovic, who will be at Eintracht next season, scored 2. He's a good player. He's a name to know. But then back came Schalke. Simon Toroda, who's like the Zweite Bundesliga's version of a hard gun. Like, he never stays in the same place for very long. He was at
hard
Hamburg
gun.
Last year. Hired gun.
Makes more sense.
Scores goals. In Bild this morning, there was someone saying that he should go to the 2022 World Cup, which, don't know about that. But he scored twice. And then the third goal, look it up if you haven't seen it, scored by a guy called Rodrigo Zalazar, who was on loan at St. Pauli last season, of all places. He's a really, really, really good player. He's on loan from the Bundesliga, I forget where, but I imagine he'll be back in Schalke next season. Watch out for him. Good footballer and fun to watch. Does a lot of things really well. But they are up.
Oh, you said Running on Empty there, which is one of Jackson Browne's best songs. And Jackson Browne's very good.
Is that your way of saying that as soon as I said that, you zoned out and started hearing that song instead?
Just thinking about Jackson Browne. Have you heard Jackson Browne's version of Take It Easy? Because he obviously wrote that, the Eagles hit. It's got a weird sort of, there's a halftime drum bit in the chorus, doesn't quite work for me.
Can you sing a little bit of it, please?
No, but this way you see how good the Eagles were. You just see how good the Eagles really were, even though they're essentially covering a song. They weren't covering it, you know, Browne wrote it so they could have it. My God, they were good. Love the Eagles.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Arsenal 2-1 Leeds.
No Eagles here.
No Eagles. No Eagles here, because the Eagles are Crystal Palace, aren't they? They should play Eagles songs when they come out. Crystal Palace, why don't they?
Because I play Glad All Over.
Or they should play, the Birds of War song from It's Always Sunny as well.
Glad All Over.
If they could combine the Birds of War song and the Eagles. All right. What's written in the notes here, the tactical deep analysis of Arsenal 2-1 Leeds is Leeds in the first half are absolutely shit. And I agree wholeheartedly with whoever wrote that sentence. Was that you, Alex?
That was me.
Yeah, yes. They were. What on earth is going on there? Like, I mean, it just falls from, I think, like, so if anyone hasn't seen what happens, it's described as a horror moment from Melier, the goalkeeper, and it sort of is. So he gets passed the ball back to him by Luke Ayling. He takes a touch. It's just slightly too loose. It's just not a perfect touch. And that alone is enough for Nketiah, who's positioned perfectly.
So well.
To accelerate onto it to score the goal. And then that just knocks confidence out of them. Mm. And then the second goal, I can't exactly remember how that happens, but it's very quickly after, because obviously they're a bit all over the place.
Really
good
nice
finish that second goal by Nketiah.
Sort of
really nice
over.
Finish.
It's in the middle of the goal. It's all right, yeah.
Leeds in the first half are an embarrassment. The Ayling tackle. Okay, so you make the emotional mistake, the mental mistake with
He's
the
wound up there, clearly, and he's just trying to leave a little bit in.
Yeah, but you're an experienced player, and you
this
know.
500.
You know if you tackle like that. You cannot. Like, you also, the two things, like.
Remember it.
you'd have probably, if you were Leeds going to this stretch of the season, you think, we're probably not going to get anything from Arsenal. Let's just be competitive, build a bit of confidence, maybe score a goal, come out of it, then go and play Chelsea in midweek at Elland Road and have a bit of a go at them. And Luke Ayling, you steam into an attack like that and you get yourself suspended for the rest of the season. When you already have a defensive shortage, as it is.
That's one thing.
You can't defend it.
I think what we should actually look at in this game is how good Martin Odegaard was. And the thing is, I think we've all known about Odegaard for a long time. I remember watching him play before he went to Real Madrid, like when he's playing for Norway and was doing mad things for the international team. He was playing in the main league there as well. Like, he started every game. He was a really big player and everyone knew he had a big talent. Went to Real Madrid, was playing in Castilla for most of the time. And then, is that the C team? And then B team is slightly different, I think, isn't it? It doesn't matter. He was there trying to work his way up the ranks. Didn't quite make it Real Madrid because it's too high a level. Probably wasn't quite there. He could 100%. And
it's a good place to develop,
right? I mean, it's hard to break through. You have to have ambition. You have to have ambition to go to Real Madrid as a youth player. Some of the things he's doing were like quite Mesut Ozil-like, where he's clipping the ball over someone's foot and then dribbling it in. He seems to always know where the next pass is. He's not a fixed positional player. He just drops wherever is needed to add the extra man. So they always have an overload wherever he is.
Yeah, I mean, he likes the right half space a lot and drifts across into that position.
I think there's data Mark Carey has. It's him and Saka link up an awful lot and it's sort of lopsided that way. Yeah.
It does. And also with Cedric pushing up on that side and it's kind of counterbalanced by Xhaka pulling across into the left a little bit more. I think the thing I like most about Odegaard, and if Odegaard adds a little bit more drive to his game, this is not a criticism of him, but that's, so if you look at Kevin De Bruyne, right, who's the best all-round midfielder in the league, then Odegaard is able to do two of the things that De Bruyne is doing, not quite as well, but almost as well. And the thing he's not quite got yet is the carry the ball through three or four players, which De Bruyne did against Newcastle in probably the best performance of the weekend with Odegaard against
Real Madrid as well.
But that link-up play, the ability to know whether it's just a simple pass backwards, a pass across, or a deft little touch, the ability to know where to be, to link up with others, the ability to feed more dynamic players. Like, Odegaard is just... he just makes the right decision so much of the time and then has the technical ability to execute.
That's what makes him elite.
Just really, really lovely.
It's the mental part. It's the mentality, isn't it?
I think he's a much better player than I thought he was going to be. I knew he was creative. I remember watching him at Sociedad and thinking, you are going to... I kind of resolving not to write him off after that Real Madrid situation. But Arsenal has shown him to be a more balletic player than I thought he was, and to have a little bit more, you know, kind of some players have a really original craft. Not just, they don't just cut, you know, reverse passes through a defensive line. They don't just, you know, loop balls over the top of centre backs. They actually have a kind of elegance with the way that they create chances. He's got that. I never really appreciated
that. It's like an Ozil that doesn't hide from the ball. I mean, Ozil was a top tier player. You can't forget he was really, I mean, I'd say Odegaard would maybe get to that level with his creative output at some point. He's a different kind of player, he's not the same. But he's always looking for it. And I agree with you, Seb. I think I expected him to do much more with it when I first saw him because he seemed like one of these wonder kids who would come through with 18 goals and 15 assists. That's what I thought would happen. But he's not. He's this kind of lovely player, a bit like David Silva was, I suppose.
This is the thing.
That's a great comparison, David Silva.
David Silva could do those things, but he also, and I think David Silva was an incredibly intelligent player. He knew when it wasn't the right thing to try and do.
Yes.
And the best players can do it all of the time, but also know when the other players on the team aren't in the right position.
Absolutely.
And so they then recycle it, they look back.
Here's a good example of who doesn't do that, I think, is like Paul Pogba, who sometimes just wants to do the things that only he can do when he doesn't need to do them in the middle of the pitch and he loses the ball. Or like Neymar trying to do a rainbow flick or something. I quite like that.
But there should be a simplicity to this. And I think one of the things I love when I watch De Bruyne, who is a wonderful, wonderful player to watch, is that he will play a simple pass in a weird way. Like, I was again watching on Sunday, and sometimes like the way he's kicking the ball sometimes is really odd. Like he'll hit it with like the top outside of his foot, or he'll do it on the stumble.
I've noticed this too. And what I think it is, what makes it work. So hopefully I can get this across and it'll make sense. He's breaking the time of what's happening. So, you know, in, I'll compare it to video games because it's my easy go-to. You know, like there's set animations that you go to where you take this step so that the animation for the pass will begin at the end of this step because that's the way that it's been built, right? So the animation has to be that way. Or like when you make a tackle, it'll be exactly 1.1 seconds they're on there because that's the animation level. De Bruyne, I think, steps in, like stretches a little bit, which is risky. People are going in with hard tackles and get them really injured and it's like 20 years ago or something. But he steps in and just stretches just to beat like what everyone else expects him to. It's like he operates in his own little time zone. Mm. And the players that do that are like Messi does it all the time.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing he does. I'm trying to think of any on top of my head. Right.
Romario used to do it. So Romario, if you look at Romario's goals, probably, you know, during his time at Barcelona or, you know, some of his goals at Brazil, for Brazil, sorry, every now and again, he'd drop in a little toe poke because he'd address a goalkeeper. And at the point, if you're a goalkeeper, you probably set your stance and proportion your weight at the point at which you expect the contact to come, which you expect the shot to be taken. And Romario did a really good job of, he would poke the ball at just before a goalkeeper had a chance to set themselves. And you look at how many of his goals resulted in the distribution of weight being slightly wrong, goalkeeper not being quite in his right position. And it's the same thing, obviously a different player and with a different purpose. But if you mess about with the expectation of when a ball is supposed to be released, you create a little bit of havoc. And I think it's a spot on point. Yeah.
I'd say because players are reading and they're anticipating what the other person is doing. A lot of it is going to be that mental thing where you're trying to read what the person is doing to react. Like I watched a thing recently with Virgil van Dijk talking about how he defends and he doesn't look at the ball, he looks at their eyes.
That's amazing, said, I remember that.
Which is probably really intimidating because then you're running straight at him but he's looking at you, it's like the Terminator. And not to talk about Terminators again, but then, yeah.
So that's one of the controversy we can do without going back on, you know.
We should round this up by talking about Man City 5-0 Newcastle. We already sort of have talking about KDB, who is just unbelievable. Like, he's one of the best players we've had in the Premier League, easily. Newcastle weren't bad in this, I didn't think. They were started all right. And then, do you know who's actually really good and probably gets a lot of praise and is also probably on the radar in the same network of corridors that the aliens are. Yeah. Yes, exactly. You knew where I was going with that to round up. See, it's a callback to earlier because this is just professional stuff. Yeah, I'm telling you what I'm doing now.
This is how you
like
podcast,
a really
right?
bad Stuart Lee. Yeah. Joao Cancelo is so good. Yeah. Like he's amazing.
Yeah.
What's the stat you've got? Who put the stat in?
I did that. I've been very diligent
this
weekend.
You did so much work today.
Yes. Really unusual for me. I did manage to watch like 5 episodes of The Mandalorian as well, so it's not been all effort.
Which season, the newest one? Not a new one out yet, is it? Because it's got Boba Fett, is it?
Yeah, so I watched the end of the first one and the first episode of the second one.
I like The Mandalorian, it's very good, isn't it?
Like it
compare
too.
The Mandalorian somehow in an analogy to Joe Cancelo.
<he's>, no.
Well, he has to adhere to the religion of Pep Guardiola. He's very much in tune exactly with that and will align himself solely with the positional play principles.
He's a foundling.
Of that, it's Cruyffism, really.
Yeah.
And he's a part of that. I mean, he's wearing the Man City armour.
Yeah.
So he's always got that on, but he has taken his mask off.
And he's revealed
that he's Joao Cancelo.
Oh, okay, that's good.
But we knew all along.
He's provided the 10th assist of the season in all competitions, his 10th, and he is the 4th Manchester City player to reach this total, which is the only side in Europe who's done that. That's the stat.
Who would Baby Yoda be?
Jack Grealish.
I knew you were going to say Jack Grealish.
Who I thought actually played all right.
Yeah.
Couple of pre-assists.
He's very powerful though, that Yoda, so it could be De Bruyne would be the Yoda sort of character. Have you watched The Mandalorian, Seb, or is this not going to work?
No, this has gone entirely over my head. I was going to say
De Bruyne's
that I
too big.
Really, really like the way that Joao Cancelo kicks footballs. The contact he makes is always so pure. We were talking about this in the pub during the first leg of the semi-final, JJ.
That's why he's so good at the bending it.
The contact is perfect every time. Yeah. Like, even if you pay no attention to where the ball goes, just watch him kick. Like watch the way he strikes the ball and the kind of the contact that he produces. It's why it's such a threat from distance as well. And why his kind of passing in that sort of 40-yard from goal area is so good. Like his contact is brilliant. I don't know how you teach that.
A couple of players that can do that as well.
It's for sure.
It was interesting because I agree with JJ. I thought Newcastle at the beginning of that game, and particularly that Chris Wood chance, which he really should have scored from.
That, yeah. Just had to put your head through it more.
They weren't competitive because they're playing Manchester City at the Etihad, right? But they were decent. They were showing up well. And it was like at the beginning of the second half, City came out and went, you've kind of taken the piss a little bit by thinking that you might be able to be okay. And they completed 101 passes without Newcastle doing a single successful pass. And they had 99% possession for the first 7 minutes of the second half.
I'm so interested to see how they develop that team.
What? My partner looked up at the TV and was like, that's not normal, is it? It's like, I've never seen that.
I want to see how they develop it because the players that we keep reading about them being linked with and how they want to go forward, Newcastle.
Oh, Newcastle.
Yeah. It's who, because they're not going for superstars just yet. There's a couple they've been linked with, players like Darwin Nunez, stuff like that. But I think what you see, like Alan Saint-Maximin, really, we talked about them so many times this season and the last previous season, whatever. Really fun to watch. There's one example where he took on players, dribbled past a couple of them, just left them hanging nowhere near him, and then he just scuffs a shot 5 yards wide. Mm. Really fun to watch, but he's not the player, is he?
Whereas when Trippier came on, almost immediately...
He gives you actual output.
There was like...
He's such a good player, Trippier, yeah.
There was a quick kind of 1-2 exchange, and then there was another bit where I think somebody, I can't remember which Newcastle player it was, but they robbed a City player of the ball, fed it out towards Trippier, who was herring up on the overlap on the right-hand side and delivered a really, really good cross that was superbly defended by Fernandinho. It would have found the Newcastle player that was not the one closest to the far post, but the one behind that. Like, that's a really good acquisition for Newcastle. It's a player in Trippier who's, you know, kind of approaching the end of his career, you know, sort of early 30s. He's going to have a couple of years left at the top level. But so good, so experienced, so professional that he immediately elevates a team. It was so clear when he came on that happened.
Before he got injured, he was scoring free kicks as well. He's really...
Yeah, so you need that kind of bracket. Like, you know, you want to sprinkle in maybe a couple... And Newcastle have this thing, don't they, about entertaining players, about players that...
And you'd want to keep some Maximin in there, I'd say. But,
sure.
But it's just like Almiron. Almiron's another one.
Something around.
Really exciting, but doesn't do anything.
I'd be surprised if... When clubs find themselves in this position, I'm surprised they don't try and buy combinations more. Like, if I was Newcastle, you'd think Nunez probably out of reach, but you could probably go to Leverkusen and sign Musa Diaby and Patrick Schick as a little combination and say, right, we'll take both of them, because then that's like you have a little bit of a jump start on developing chemistry. I don't know if it works quite like that in reality. It just seems a sort of, if you have the financials to support that sort of approach, which obviously they do, it's a good way of kind of...
I mean, they could buy Real Madrid.
There was really good work done by a guy called Ben Darwin, who was a international rugby player for Australia. He was a prop, and then he got a neck injury and had to retire, I think, and started working in rugby analytics instead, and developed a thing where he would look at player combinations. So in rugby, you'd look at the halfbacks, the 9 and 10, or you'd look at the back row, 6, 7, 8. And he found that international teams that had a higher proportion of club-related pairings in particular areas tended to do better. And it's somebody actually asked it as a question in the comments of the most recent TIFO football show, which was released today. Like, why do we not see that happen more with international teams in football? But also, exactly like you say, Seb, if you've got the financial muscle to go out and buy partnerships, you know, if it's a midfield double pivot or if it's a winger and a striker, that makes a lot of sense. Presuming that the team you're buying from also plays stylistically in a fairly similar way to the way you want to play. Otherwise, you're just picking up a unit and sticking it into something that doesn't work. But it's a really good idea.
I mean, I'm a rugby league fan, more than Union now. And I always think of like that combination, that importing like players into representative teams. So I think about like a Queensland Maroons team during the that kind of era of Origin dominance. They're able to play Cooper Cronk, Cameron Smith, and Billy Slater in the same team. Now, in football terms, it's like that's three decisive points in your team. And across sport, it doesn't really matter because it's the same. You have your reference point, and what you're importing is actually the way those players behave in relation to one another. And so if you're able to have that, you have to add systems around them, sure. You have to have defensive compensations and all that kind of stuff. But it just saves you about 6 months, surely. Like in a representative team, say rugby, football, whatever, instead of having to do that kind of accelerated chemistry building that you have to do climbing mountains or going on kind of marine training camps ahead of a World Cup, you just go, right, we're just going to have these players all play with each other at club level, and then we don't have to do that. Then we have a kind of a baseline level of performance that can be relied upon. I don't know. I suppose, obviously, the caveat is you have to be able to afford Patrick Schick and Moussa Diaby, which is probably £100 million. But yes. At the same time, you could roll that out and, buy players in twos or threes.
Well, do you know what is affordable? Do you know what is affordable?
Is it The Athletic? Because that's very affordable. It's really
affordable. If you go to
Tfoot.com. And also, don't buy that in bundles. Just buy one of those. Just The Athletic. Don't buy The Athletic and another, subscription to something else. Just buy The Athletic.
Don't buy any of the competition.
Nah.
Only The Athletic.
Competition's rubbish.
I think that's a good way just to end it, because we've been talking for quite a while now. So yes, with that, I think we've summed everything up. We've completed it. Well done, everyone. Well done, Alex Stewart.
Thanks, JJ. That means a lot.
Well done, Seb Stafford-Bloor.
Thank you, JJ Bull.
Thank you to producer Craig. He's over in the corner with no camera on him. We do film this, by the way, so you can watch that on TIFO IRL, which you should definitely go to, and you can see the TIFO show that Alex mentioned before, which we put an awful lot of effort into and would like more views. So please go and watch that on the channel. That's it. Thanks very much for watching. I think Joe's back next week, hopefully. We'll see. And then, yes, that's it. Have a lovely week, everyone. Have a great time. Toodaloo!